Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
What's up, guys? It's the phenomenal AJ Styles. You're listening to the two-man power trip.
Hey, Johnny. Cool, man. What's going on? We ready to go or what?
Welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. I'm your host, JP John Paz. With me today, very special guest, former USWA world champion, former CWA tag team champion. He is, of course, known as Mantar or Tank. He is Mike Halleck. Mike, welcome to the two-man power trip. How you doing?
Hey, good evening, John. It's a pleasure to be here on your show, the two-man power trip. I've been waiting a long time for this day, brother. I'm glad it finally came.
Oh, yeah. So what's going on in your world? What have you been up to?
Man, I'm just living a good life here in Florida. 85 degrees today, man. They said the weather this time, this year, at this point, has never been better in the last 20 years. So we're definitely soaking up the sun, soaking up the palm trees, and just, you know, starting to hit the beach. They just opened up the beach the other day, so going to be going there this weekend, man. So I'm excited, man. I'm down here living my best life, bro.
Nice. That's awesome. That is great. And you mentioned before, I don't know if I should mention this on air, but you mentioned certain things, you know, in pain. Obviously, that's what happens in wrestling, taking all those bumps. So how are you feeling physically?
You know what? Physically, I can't really complain. I mean, I could complain, but who the fuck's going to listen, right?
Right.
I got a plate in my back. I got a plate in my neck. I've had surgery on both wrists. I've had surgery on both elbows. You know, I'll be 55 in a couple of weeks. And, you know, if I would have known way back when what I know now, I would have done things a little bit differently. You know what I mean?
Yep. Oh, yeah, for sure. When you look at that and you're looking at, you know, maybe taking pills and stuff, was that something that most guys did? Very common? You just take pills, you're in so much pain, things like that?
Oh, yeah. A lot of guys took oxycodones, you know, they took somas, they took Valiums. You know, some guys, you know, smoked weed, some guys did cocaine, a lot of guys drank beer. You know, I was never really a big beer drinker, so I never drank too much, and I wasn't really a pill guy, even though a bunch of clowns decided they wanted to slip me about 10 or 15 Mickeys in the Denver fucking airport, but that's a whole other story.
So what is that story? Because I know that that's kind of been out there, been said before, like, oh, you know, it was either X-Pac or somebody had kind of slipped you something. And I know Duke Drosy kind of said something different. So what is that story? Like, what happened?
Well, so I think there was myself, Adam Bomb, the 1-2-3 kid. I think the Dumpster was there. I think Shawn Michaels might have been there. There was six or eight of us just hanging out at the airport in Denver. Because we all came from L.A. and we were on an L.A. trip for like 30 days, right? So we were all flying back home for a day or two before we had to be back on TV. And so our plane was delayed because there was a fucking huge snowstorm outside. And so we're drinking, sitting at the airport drinking, man, and taking pills. You know, at that time, fuck, I probably took 5 or 6 pills of my own. You know, I probably took a couple painkillers, a couple Valiums. I can't remember exactly. But I know that I was taking some myself. Willingly, and then I made the Green Horn rookie mistake of leaving my beer on the table when I went to take a piss. And you know, I never would have thought that these guys would have took a shot at me like that, right? Because they could have fucking killed me, to be honest with you. I mean, Adam Bomb was really concerned. He was like, Horn, he was like, I want you to call me, bro, as soon as you get home. And then he says, I want you to call me when you wake up. And I was like, okay. And this was like, I don't know, 11 o'clock in the morning, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. And we've been drinking and stuff. So I get on the airplane back to Nebraska. And I have a couple of fucking beers on the airplane, man. And I get back to Nebraska, and I am fucking wired to the gills, man. I'm going 300 miles an hour, and I don't know why. And, you know, sometimes when you pill somebody, it has an opposite effect on them, right? Because it should have fucking knocked me out, man. I should have been fucking sleeping. And for a long ass time, right, for 12, 13 hours. And but I wasn't, man. I ended up getting home. I was up all fucking night. And I remember calling Adam Bomb about 10 o'clock the following morning. He was like, Warren, you made it. He was like, man, he says, you're a fucking elephant, bro. He says, these guys would have had to fucking harpoon your ass to put you down, man. He says, you were standing tall. And I says, bro, you want to hear something funny? I says, when I got up and left the table, I went to catch my plane. I says, I'm walking down the fucking jetway, and walking towards me is Jerry Briscoe, Pat Patterson, and Vince McMahon. And I'm like, I know that I'm fucked up, right? I mean, I can feel it. I don't know if I was weaving back and forth or not, but, you know, Vince said, hey, Mike, how you doing? I was like, good, Vince, you? And I said hello to Pat and Jerry, and I just kept right on boogieing, man. And I'm like, these guys had to know that I was fucked up, right? And so I called Brian, and he was like, man, he says, what time did you get to bed, man? He says, you sleep on the plane? I says, sleep on the fucking plane? I says, you're funny, bro. I says, I've been up all fucking night, and I haven't been to sleep yet. He was like, what? He was like, oh, my God. He says, you really are a fucking elephant, man. He says, the fuckers are going to have to harpoon your ass next time to put you down. He says, they must have put 20 fucking pills in your drink.
Holy shit.
And he says, I was so worried about you, man. He says, that's why I said, man, call me when you get back to the bar. I say, call me when you get up in the morning, man. Just make sure that you fucking wake up, right? And, It was unbelievable, man. But no, they couldn't knock the fucking Mantar down, buddy. I'm half man, half fucking beast, and 100% man, buddy. I'm 400 pounds of fucking man. You only gonna take more than a few pills to knock me down.
Yeah, oh shit. But that is dangerous, though. Playing those type of games.
Real dangerous, man. That's Russian roulette, basically. You know, because
a lot of guys, man, have died of overdoses, right? Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, Eddie Guerrero, a lot of fucking guys, right? A lot of guys.
And, you know, the fans just might not know it, but the fucking boys know what's going on, right? The boys know who's dying or what, you know? But I can't tell you how many wrestlers have died from a fucking pill overdose, man.
Fucking crazy. And to think that these motherfuckers tried to fucking do that shit to me, man,
really pisses me off. And they're fucking good damn lucky that I never had to work with any of them, right? I mean, I worked with Duke, and I worked with Adam Bomb, and we always had great matches, man. There was no heat there. But as far as them motherfucking pricks, man, No, I don't. That shit don't fly.
Did you ever say anything to him? Like what? Like what the fuck, guys? You know.
Well, you know, I'm the type of person that
you know, you fuck me once,
fuck me. You fuck me twice, fuck you. And I figured if it came down to the ring when we were wrestling, man, that I would cash in my receipt, right? Because I definitely had a big fucking receipt to cash in. And but they're lucky that I never got to wrestle any of them, man.
Crazy the times back then. Yeah. Oh my god.
Oh yeah, man. Drugs were fucking rampant. I mean, Razor was in and out of fucking treatment. Seemed like every other fucking month. You know, and they kept giving him a push and a push and a push. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? You know, I almost knocked the shit out of this fucking mouth in the ring when we had a match. Fucking prick.
Now, you mentioned being half man, half beast, and obviously that was the gimmick, but how'd you get into the WWF? Well, we'll kind of start there with the run there, since we're on the WWF time period right now. Like, how does that character come about? How do they find you? How do they get you?
So I started wrestling in the CWA over in Europe in 91, 92. And I wrestled over there every year. And I was over there, I would say, the winter of 95. And Ted DiBiase just came off TV after the 1-2-3 Kid beat him on Monday Night Raw. So that was when his release was up. So he came over to Europe and wrestled a championship over there. And both Ted and I are originally from Omaha, Nebraska. We are both SOB, South Omaha boys. And so I looked after Teddy when he came over to Austria, over to Vienna, and he was there for like 5 or 6 days. And I took really good care of him. He said, listen, man, he says, you're a big dude. He said, you fly around, man. You're very light on your feet. He said, I love your work. He said, I'm sure Vince will love you. He said, give me a call 2 weeks before you're leaving here on your way home. And he says, and I'll give Vince a call. And they'll have a look at you. I was like, okay. And so I called him. So like 2.5 months went by, 2-3 months went by. So finished the tour. A couple weeks before the end, I called Teddy up. I said, Teddy, I'll be home a week before Christmas. He was like, okay, great. I'll let Vince know. And so
literally, I got the letter on the 26th of December, the FedEx letter, to fly out on the 27th. Excuse me. And
the rest is history. They brought me up to New York, picked me up in a limousine, drove me up to Connecticut. And, you know, they said that they would have Creative come up with some stuff. And Creative came up with like 3 or 4 ideas. And they kind of liked this one. And I really didn't like any of the ideas, right? But who am I to say, hey, man, this is fucking shit, right? And I'm the type of person that I like to make chicken salad out of chicken shit. And so I feel that, you know, I've done that. You know, 30 years later, people are still talking about Mantar. And, you know, I must have done something right, whether they remember the fucking big bullhead that Vince paid $100,000 for it, I only, or half a dozen times, or whether they remember me belly-to-belly suplexing guys in the next week. Right out of the textbook. So no matter what they remember, man, they still remember Mantar. And so I'm pretty proud of that.
That bullhead cost $100,000, really?
Yeah, man. Vince flew me to Chicago like 4 times, had the girls design shit, and he flew me to New York like 3 or 4 times. And I was, remember, I was in one of them high rises on like the 75th floor and in some fucking sweatshop. Where they were making all these designs and they were designing this fucking bullhead. And so they got it designed
and the drawings that they had looked menacing, right? But the finished product
looked like fucking Bessie the Cow. And
they were like, well, we got to go with it. And so I was like, well, okay, you know, whatever. And so I designed it to fit like shoulder pads or on my shoulders, and I would strap it down so the fucker wouldn't go to work, because it was probably 40 pounds or more, right? I mean, it wasn't a fucking light thing. It had all that fur on it, and fucking thing was like 2 foot taller than me, right? It was fucking huge. And I'm talking through the mouth, and I remember doing the first TV shot. I forget where we were, and I was right in the gorilla position,
And Vince McMahon says, anybody got Mike in the ring yet with this fucking bullhead on? He says, this fucking thing is massive. And he was like, no, Vince. He was like, fuck. He was like, I'm telling you, he says, we got to scratch this shit. And I remember I grabbed him fucking around his triceps and biceps, and I shook him, and I talked to him through the mouth. I said, Vince, I got this.
He says, don't you worry, I got this.
And he was like, okay, kid, if you say so. He said, good luck. And fucking, I went out there, climbed up the fucking, he's like, what's your plan? I was like, I'm going to climb up the corner, and I climbed right back down on the inside. So when you actually see it, you know, it probably took me a little while to get up, climb up the fucking corner and climb down on the inside. And so they showed me taking like two steps up, and then they cut it to where I was taking the last step down on television, right? But yeah, it made it look realistic, and it worked out great, and I didn't trip and fall, and, you know, all was good.
That is so crazy, though. Like, he's willing to spend that much money on, like, this character. Like, what did you think about that? Like, wow, he's going to go all the way with it. He's going to go further with this. Like, what did you think about that?
Yeah, you know, that's personally, I would rather have done my gangster character that I did over in Europe, right? I was a big fucking gangster. I had a tearaway suit. I had a fedora. Sometimes I carried a briefcase that I loaded before I hit guys over the fucking head with it. I would hit it on the canvas, load that fucker up, and fucking bash him in the head. Or I would have a walking stick that I would use. And I really love that character. And, you know, this was before Mr. Hughes. And so I would have been the first Mr. Hughes. But they, you know, they wanted to do this half man, half beast. They were in that gimmick mode at that era, at that time frame, right? And so they were trying to create fucking, I don't know, characters. And it was like, we're going to say you're from the Isle of Crete and base your character off the Minotaur. And I was like, okay, man, whatever you say. And then one day after I wore the fucking bullhead for 5 or 6 times, I showed up to television and they said, well, we want to change up the gimmick. I was like, well, fuck it. Thank God for that, man. You know, I'm tired of wearing that fucking bullhead. And so they would want to cut your hair into horns and put makeup on your face. And I was like, okay. So Jerry K. Waller got his clippers out. We went to the locker room and he shaved the fucking horns on. And it took me probably about 2 weeks to reshape them to where they were absolutely perfect. Because I'm totally anal about shit like that. You know, I'm not going to go out there with one horn up here and one horn down here. You know what I mean? It just looks fucking stupid. And so, but it took me, you know, a week or two to kind of trim it up and get them to where they were perfect. But once I got them, man, I just shaved them every fucking day, and that's how I walked around with fucking horns on my head for a year.
When you initially got pitched that gimmick, I know you're saying, like, okay, you know, you'll do whatever, but who is doing the pitching? Is it Bruce Pritchard and Vince? They sit you down? Like, how does that happen?
It was Bruce Pritchard and Vince. I mean, I remember when I first met Vince, I met with J.J. Dillon and Vince. But when it came time to talking about the character, because they flew me up like, I don't know, maybe a week later, we signed a contract, and then I went home and they flew me back up, and that's when I met with the creative people and sat down with Pritchard. They already had some drawings, you know, they took some pictures of me when I was up there. And so when I came back a week later, they already had, you know, different shit, you know, drawn and things like that. So that's when Pritchard and Ben sat me down and said, this is what we want to go at.
What did they say to you, like, hey, we see, because, you know, like they say, like, Dirty White Boy, like, oh, you were a plumber, you look like a plumber, like, you're going to be a plumber. Like, what did they say to you? You look like an animal. We're going to make you an animal. You know what I mean? Like, how's the pitch go?
You know, they were like Mikey's. They says, you know, you got one set of fucking massive thighs on you. You know, you're wearing a size 16 fucking shoe. You know, you got fucking bull legs, man. And they said, so we want to make you half man, half bull. And call you Mantar, and based off the Greek mythological character, the Minotaur. He says, bottom half will be the man, and the top half will be the fucking bull. And I was like, okay, man. And so they didn't say, we want you to do this specific thing. You know, so when I would put my head down and charge him, or I would do the Mantar shuffle where I would shuffle my feet and my arms, like train kind of, you know, that's all shit that I just came up with on my own. You know, they didn't tell me specifically what they wanted to do. I remember one time when I did a finish, I came back to the locker room,
and they were like, we want you to do these two finishes back to back.
So I'd go back out there and do these two finishes, and one of them was just fucking front slam my guy, standing up, doing the fucking big woo, and just falling on him like a sack of shit, right? That was CJ Strombo's idea. I was like, man, please don't make me fucking do that shit, man. So, you know.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Oh, it was fucking rotten, man. And so finally, I just did it to where I caught the guy in a crossbody and just fucking jumped up and fucking backed up a couple steps, come off the ropes and fucking buried him, right?
But did Strombo doing that to rib you, or was he dead serious?
No, he was dead serious, man. He was serious as a fucking heart attack.
Wow.
I mean, I was like, Chief, I said, you really want me to do this?
He's like, yeah, man, you're 400 pounds. He says, make that big fucking call and just fall on him like a sack of potatoes. I was like, you mean like a sack of shit, Chief?
Come on. You know, so, but I went out there and did it out of respect for him. Luckily, they didn't have me do it. But yeah, they made me go out there three different times, I think, in one match and do three different finishes. Stupid.
Testing stuff out, seeing what works, what doesn't work. But obviously, you knew the sack of shit thing is not going to work.
Yeah, I just wasn't feeling it, right?
So when, like, you're coming along, you're doing this character, who is the person, like, in creative at this point? Is it Bruce or is it more Vince?
No, it was Bruce. And, of course, Vince always has his say in something, right? So but Bruce was the number one guy. And then he ran everything through fucking Vince. So, you know, it was Bruce's idea. And, you know, Bruce was a backstabbing prick. You know, he acted like he reached my face, but he really didn't, right? For some reason, something rubbed him wrong, I don't know.
So you didn't get along with Bruce at all?
Not really, man. I used to drive up and down the fucking road with Tom, you know, Doc Pritchard. And, you know, we used to smoke a lot of fucking weed. And maybe that's why he didn't like me, right? Because he knew that if I was riding with his brother, and I was smoking weed, and, you know, it was illegal until they were testing you. And, you know, so, yeah, Bruce Pritchard was a fucking prick.
What was it about Bruce that, like, he was saying to your face that he wasn't saying behind your back, or, you know, vice versa? But what was he doing? What was he saying?
Well, you know, when it came down to it, I remember. So fast forward a couple, 2-3 years, and Bret Hart brings me back to do the Truth Commission gimmick, right? And so he called me up. I was wrestling in Germany. He called me up and he said, Mike, he's like, I want you to be a part of this six-man tag. He says, I got two greenhorns and yourself. And he says, and I got a guy that does the Kellogg's commercials in South Africa. He says that he's going to be the mouthpiece. We're going to make him the commandant. You guys are going to be the soldiers. And you've already been on TV, so we're going to put a mask on you. I was like, do you think that's really going to matter, Brett? He's like, listen, this is just how we drew it up. I said, okay. So they put a mask on me. He says, we want you to train these guys. We're going to send you to Memphis for 6 months or so. And you guys get to give it down, and then we'll call you up, and we'll go with it. I was like, okay, Brett. So I went back and spent, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months in fucking Memphis. Almost broke my neck. Russell, Jerry Lawler in Louisville, Kentucky. The Louisville Gardens in front of like 12,000 fucking people on a Tuesday. And took a couple months off. And I came back maybe a month early. And I probably should have took that extra month off, you know, in hindsight. But I came back a month early. And, you know, he did like 3 televisions, and the 4th television was in Des Moines, Iowa, in my hometown, like 2 hours away from me. And I had been, you know, off for a week. And so I go up there, and as soon as I walk in the door, Bruce says, you know, well, we want a piss test you. I was like, okay, piss test me. And, you know, and I know I'm clean,
And so I pissed test, and I'm walking, I think I'm walking to catering. And he's like, hey, Mike, Bruce, this is Bruce Pritchard. Hey, Mike, let me talk to you. So it was Bruce. I said, yeah, what's up, Bruce? He said, hey, man. He said, I just want to tell you, man, that you failed your piss test, and we're going to have to let you go. I was like, what? I said, I didn't fail no fucking piss test. I ain't smoking, been smoking no weed. I said, you're a fucking liar. He says, I'm telling you right now, bro, you failed the piss test, and we're going to let you go. And I was like, dude, I says, you're a fucking piece of shit. And I said, I'm going to fucking see you guys. And I remember, he said, go ahead, big man. And he says, good luck with that. He says, because you ain't got a chance of beating Vince. And I was like, man, fuck you, you piece of shit. And I grabbed my shit, and I fucking went home, man. And they had replaced me with a buddy of mine that I wrestled with over in Europe, Rambo. His name was Luke Poirier. He's a French-Canadian, great worker. And they replaced him, or me, with him. And, you know, the way I look at it is, if they'd have replaced me with some fucking jabroni, I'd have been pissed off. But they didn't. They replaced me with a buddy that I've worked with every night for like the past 6 years, right? Good friend of mine. And so it didn't really bother me too much, you know. I was like, well, fuck it. And then after that, they got rid of the commandant and brought the Jackal in. And then they were on TV, I don't know, for a few months, and then they just kind of fucking petered out.
Yeah, basically, they didn't really last too long. But did you really fail the test, or was he fucking with you?
No, he was just fucking with me, but he still fucking fired me on the spot. He said, you failed your fucking piss test. He says, you can no longer work for this company. We're going to have to let you go. I'm like, what? And I knew that I was clean, right? I was like, I want to see the fucking results. He was like, I don't have them. So the doctor got him. He says, what do you think, I'm lying? I says, yeah, motherfucker, you're lying. I mean, it was a big hullabaloo. Right in the middle of this big fucking open area, because I was walking to fucking catering. And you had to walk through this big ass fucking room and go through some doors. And then on the other side, you had to go through another set of doors. And I was like halfway in. And like Bruce was fucking following me. So he was a man on a mission, man. I don't know what his hard on was for me, but like I said, he acted like he liked me doing the fucking Mantar character, but then. When he came to the Truth Commission, the very first chance he got to fucking fire me, he fucking fired me. So I don't know what's up his fucking ass.
Man, he just didn't like you for whatever reason. Yeah.
No, I guess I didn't suck no dick, so they didn't fucking want me around, right? I mean, because I'm not one of them ass kissers, you know. I'm not a yes man, and you know, you're not gonna make me look fucking stupid. And I remember when I had to wrestle Bob Sparkplug Holly, I think it was a Survivor Series. And
then we wrestled like 9 minutes maybe.
And I literally fucking threw him around like a rag doll. Just beat the fucking shit out of him, man. Threw him, did everything to him. And then at the end, he hit me with that fucking missile dropkick off the top rope. And he pinned me 1, 2, 3. And I remember when he got me 1, 2, 3. People start chanting, bullshit, bullshit. They knew that shit wasn't real because I beat the fucking shit out of him. That's the only thing he got was the fucking finish, and he pinned me, right? I was like, man, I packed my bag and I was like, fuck you motherfuckers, I'm done with you. This is what I do as a Mantar character, right? Because I'm like, you're not going to destroy me. You're not going to make me look fucking bad, right? Because I might go somewhere else to fucking work.
Yeah, definitely. With that, like, were they supposed to do more with Mantar? Like, you know, you're saying, like, you lost to Bob Holly, but you kind of dominated the match. Were they supposed to do more with the character?
Listen, at one time, they were talking about having a feud with The Undertaker.
Wow.
You know? And, I mean, the word was around the locker room that I was stiff. And, okay, you know what, that's true, because when I would work with you, I would say, listen, if you're going to drop kick me, or you're going to close on me, or you're going to fucking punch me, lay that shit in. Because if you don't, I'm not fucking selling it. Because I'm 410 fucking pounds, and you're not going to make me look stupid out there. I said, I would rather have you fucking stiff me than fucking miss me by a fucking country mile. Right? And so I would tell everybody to wrestle up front. And I remember the night it was Moline, Illinois. I took one of my best friends. It was like an 8-hour drive up to Moline.
Go up there for television, Monday Night Raw.
And I got there and I found out that I had to wrestle Bret Hart.
And
Jerry Briscoe says, hey, Mike, he says, Brett wants to talk to you before the match. I was like, yeah, okay, no problem. So Brett and I got together. He's like, hey, listen, man. He says, I just want to be up front with you. He says, nobody wants to work with you. Everybody says you're fucking stiff, that you're fucking hurting them. And he says, but you know what? He says, I love your style of fucking work. And he says, I can appreciate a guy who lays that shit in and makes it look real. He said, after all, he said, this isn't fucking ballet. And he said, they're just a bunch of fucking prima donnas in this locker room, right? And he was like, so let's go up there and have a good match. And we laid it out. Boom. We went out there and fucking killed it. I mean, killed it. Vince, when Brett got back to the locker room, he went right to fucking Vince and said, Vince, this fucking guy can work. I don't know what everybody else is talking about, but this guy's a great worker. And I just had fucking one of my best matches that I ran out there with Mike. And he says, it was good. He says, we went over it. And he says, we went out there and fucking killed it. And I remember when it was on, I think they put it on Superstars. And
Action Zone. Day,
yeah, the Action Zone on Saturday morning. Yep. And I remember they kept the most important part of the match out. And fucking Brett called me up. He said, did you see that shit? And I was like, yeah. He says, man, he says, I'm going to take care of that shit, man. He said, that was bullshit. He said, they just kept the best part of our fucking match out of it. And he said, so it made no sense. He said, we planned it out, boom, boom, boom. And he says, it went fucking smooth as silk. And they kept the most important part of the fucking match out. He was pissed. Fucking pissed.
Really? Because I remember, because I watched it not that long ago. It's on YouTube. It's a pretty good match, but I think it's, you know, it's long for a TV match, but it's actually longer, so they cut some stuff out of it?
They cut some stuff out, you know.
Wow.
And I remember when Brett was making his comeback, I think he dropped the fucking punch off the second rope, and then he did the fucking Russian leg sweep on me, and...
And something happened. We went outside, and I had him up against the fucking post. And I went to punch him, and he moved. And I ended up punching the fucking post for real. And you could hear my fucking hand hit the fucking post. He was like stiffy. He started laughing. And but we went out and had a great match. And Brett was pretty pissed off. They cut the best part of the match out. But yeah, Brett's a great guy, man. He was probably one of my best matches ever.
What'd you think about, just in general, his work in the ring? I mean, everyone highly regards him as one of the best. Do you agree? One of the best ever?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I would say he's probably the best Canadian to ever come out of Canada. You know, I seem to tell you, somebody asked me, tell you, Neidhart, about here are the top three or four people in Canada, and she said Bret Hart, Stu Hart, Owen Hart, and then she threw out Edge out there, right? And he says Edge is, you know, past his prime, but he's still out there killing it, you know. And people know he's in pain, but he's still out there killing it. So, you know, more power to him, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Now, with Undertaker, why'd they scrap that feud? How come it never happened?
I have no idea. I have no idea, because I remember one day Taker came up to me. He's like, hey, big man. He said, I just want to let you know, man, that, you know, we're going to do a little fucking spiel together. He said, so get ready, man. He said, welcome to the big time. I was like, thanks, bro. And I'm like, I remember he walked away and I fucking looked up at the sky. I was like, wow, man, thank you, God. You know, because all you need to do is have a good feud with fucking Taker to elevate your status on the roster, right? And yep. So that would have been a chance of a lifetime for me.
What did you think about him as the conscience, the locker room leader? What did you think about him as the person?
Yeah, I totally agree with that assessment. You know, he definitely was the voice of the locker room. He definitely carried all the respect there. And if, you know, Mark said something to you, you'd listen to him, right? Because he definitely knew what he was talking about.
Was there a lot of locker room dissension, like BSK, which is obviously his group, The Click, which is Michael's group, and those guys? Like, was there a lot of that dissension? Because some people said yes, and some people said, eh, no, it's not. It's kind of more overblown by the fans than it really was.
No, absolutely not, man. The Click was fucking for real, man. If somebody in The Click didn't like you, you were gone. And that's what happened to me, man. I almost got in a fight with Razor in the ring. Actually did get into a little fight. Got in a fight with them in the locker room. And shit, 2 months later in Survivor Series, I did a job for Bob Holly and the Mantar was done, right? And I knew that it fucking came from that, man. But I didn't care, man. Like I said, I'm not a yes man. I ain't no fucking punk. You're not going to try and knock me out in the middle of the ring with the fucking open hand slap. Because if you think that shit's fucking going to fucking knock me down, you're fucking out of your mind, man. You know, fucking Razor hit me with an open hand slap and hit me as hard as he fucking could. And I just fucking shook that shit off, man, and fucking picked him up and put him in the corner and start fucking blasting him. And I remember Vince got the fucking referee's ear, and he was like, tell them two fuckers to save that shit in the back. They're on national TV.
Wow, really?
Yeah, yeah. Razor was a fucking prick.
So what happened? He just did his normal open hand slap, or he was trying to be a little aggressive with
it? So at this point in time, I was undefeated in the WWF, right? I was, I don't know, maybe 15 or 16 and fucking all. I haven't lost yet. And Razor just came back from his 1700th time in drug rehab. And before he went into drug rehab, he dropped the belt to Double J and Nerone. And so he came out of fucking rehab, and I was his very first match out of fucking rehab. And so they said, okay, well, we're not going to, you know, Mantar's undefeated, and we know that Scott, you're already established, but we don't want to fucking beat him clean in the fucking ring. And so they said, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do a thing where fucking the Razor gives you the fucking Razor's Edge or something, and then the fucking roadie pops up on the fucking apron, gets Razor's attention, I fucking recover, I'm at Razor's back now. Razor's over by the roadie, and the roadie's got his attention and his back to me. I get up. I do the fucking Mantar shuffle. I charge him. Razor fucking sees me, sidesteps me, throws me over the top rope. I land on the fucking roadie, and we got counted out 10, right? Well, when we first started talking about the match, you know, Razor's like, I want to get this in. I want to get that in. And, you know, and I know that he can do it to big guys, all this shit that he's calling, right? And because I've seen him. See him do it. See him do the shit to Vader and stuff. So, you know, if he can do this other shit to Vader, he can do it to me, right? And so I was like, all right, man. I was like, but listen, I want to get my shit in too. You know, I says, I haven't lost yet. I says, I'm trying to build a name for myself. And I says, and so, you know, it's going to be a give or take, or it's going to be nothing at all. And he's like, oh, we'll go out there and have a good match, man. We'll go out there and have a good match. So we went out there in the very first fucking spot. You know how Razor spits his fucking, flicks his toothpick at the motherfuckers. Well, we did this opening spot where I pushed him off a couple of times, went to lock up again, went to throw him a clothesline. He ducked the fucking clothesline, took his toothpick out, and fucking flicked it at me. And then he fucking, so we locked up a fucking second time. He ducked the clothesline again. I turned around, he open hand slaps me. And so when he open hand slapped me, bro, he tried to slap the chiclets out of my mouth. And I've heard Diesel talk about this on a few podcasts before. And when Diesel tells it, where he's sitting in the back with the boys in the fucking catering and watching it on the monitor. And he says, next thing I know, man, Scott's wrestling fucking Mantar. And Scott hit fucking Mantar so hard, man, he knocked the fucking snot out of his mouth. And he said, I thought he fucking should have knocked his ass out. I think, man, he was fucking far from it, man. And I remember, you know, when he fucking opened the hand, fucking slapped me, man, I shook that shit off and fucking scooped him up, threw him in the fucking corner, bam, 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 and fucking fight was on. And then next thing you know, Vince McMahon's on the fucking earpiece telling us to calm down. We're on national TV. Right? So then we got in the fucking back. So after I get the count out of 10, fucking I jump up, man, I fucking go right to the fucking behind the curtain. I'm waiting for this motherfucker. He comes to it. He got right in his fucking face, man. And we start fucking pushing and shoving, calling fucking names and shit. Agents start fucking pulling us the fucking part. Yeah, Scott Hall is a fucking pussy. I don't give a shit if he's dead or not. Still a fucking pussy.
Was it like just legit heat between you guys? Did it just get heated in the ring? I mean, he just didn't like you
He just obviously he took a fucking liberty, right? Because he got along with my fucking partner, PN News, really well in WCW. Listening to my partner tell the story, right? They got along great. And but for some reason, Scott didn't fucking like me. And, you know, when I was over in Europe, I missed Scott by like 2 years, I think. He was over at WrestleCon, but it's over there as well. Because anybody who is somebody has wrestled in that territory, who's old school wrestler. They wrestled for Autobahns in that German-Austrian territory, right? And So yeah, man, I don't know why you didn't like me. You just took a cheap shot, and I let you know right then and there I wasn't gonna fucking have it. And you know, I called out the fucking one of the main dudes in the fucking clique, and 2 months later, fucking Bob Holly's fucking pinned me right in the middle of the fucking ring.
That shows you, yeah, the power, the politics. Yeah, you gotta find that mind killer. Yeah,
the click was fucking strong, bro. I mean, if they didn't like you, you were doomed. Guaranteed, you were doomed. You know, and like I said, I was no ass kisser. I was one of them guys that was. I'm like the lone wolf, right? I don't need no fucking pack. I don't need no fucking friends. It's always nice to have friends watch your back, right? But I don't need anybody, man. I can ride alone, and I rode alone.
Yeah, it's funny because like that happens. You start losing to Duke Dumpster Drosa. You start losing to Man Mountain Rock. You kind of see the writing on the wall. Like, I'm getting jobbed out here, and then obviously Bob Holly on TV and pay per view. So,
yeah, once that happened, man, you know, I just said, "Fuck it, I'm done." I remember I went in the back, I took my gear off, I fucking cleaned the paint off my face. I didn't even take a shower. And I just fucking got my bags, got my car, and then went to the airport. And I was calling on the way to the airport to change my ticket back to Omaha.
Man, just it's crazy to think, like, did they really think that gimmick was going to work? And then they were giving you something, but that, you know, and then that happens and you start losing. Did you really think that gimmick would work, though, in that era or no?
You know, for the time, for the era that was going on, they had all them stupid fucking gimmicks, right?
Yep.
I mean, all of them. They had the fucking Repo Man, they had the Red Rooster, they had the Bastion Booger, they had Duke the Dumpster Drosy. You know, they had all these stupid fucking gimmicks. And, you know, it was just that time where they just, you know, instead of making a character himself
or someone,
a persona that has to do with myself, an alter ego or something, they put me in, you know, make me do something that I'm not even involved in.
When you do leave, you do come back a few times. Like you mentioned the time with the Truth Commission. Like, who keeps bringing you back? Like, you returned 96, you returned 97. Like, how does that keep happening?
You know, and I also, a lot of people don't know this, but they brought me back also to do the gangster character that I thought they should have done when they did the Mantar character. They wanted me to do the bodyguard character for Goldust in Your House pay-per-view in Omaha, Nebraska against the Ultimate Warrior because right. Goldust blew a Z out over in fucking Europe on the European tour. And they were the main event, and they couldn't cancel. It was too late. And so they was like, okay, we'll pay you. We want to use this character. So they knew what character I was doing, right?
Yep.
But they still chose to put this fucking Mantar character on me. It makes no sense.
So who brought you back to be with Goldust, though? Like, who? It's not Bruce Pritchard, right? Is it Jim Ross?
I want to say it was Jim Ross or J.J. Dillon, one of them. It might have been Jim Ross. You know, I don't think Jim Ross liked me very much either. But he asked me if I was interested. I said, yeah. And I said, okay, well, we'll give you $5,000 and, you know, come in and do this. But when I got to the arena, they said, okay, Mike, this is what we want to do. But we have to wait and run it by the Ultimate Warrior. To make sure that he's okay with doing it, because if he's not okay with it, we can't do it. And I was like, okay, so Warrior Freeman came, showed up like 4 o'clock, and talked to him, and we got it all worked out, and it worked out fairly smooth.
What did you think of Warrior? What did you think of him?
He was a great guy, very professional. I've heard a lot of horror stories about him with the ego trip and just not showing up. And, you know, if he doesn't want to do it, you know, we can't do it. We got to do what he wants to do and all that shit. So I don't know, you know, he was a great guy. You know, we went in there, we did it, it was easy. And, you know, after he clotheslined me over the top, rope backwards, my hat fell off and he picked it up and put it on a sucking head and climbed up to the top rope and did his warrior thing. So he's up there promoting fucking Bruiser Mastino in my fucking, wearing my Falcadora, right? So, all good, quick $5,000 for me.
Did you think it was going to lead to something longer and like a longer stay there and you were going to be Goldust's like bodyguard full time?
I was hoping, you know, because we really worked out a good thing. I mean, you know, it all went down as planned. It was smooth as silk and they were very happy with it. And Goldust was happy with it. He was really happy because, you know, his fucking knee was in a brace. He couldn't fucking hardly walk. He was basically on crutches. And, you know, he had Marlena there, and we all worked great together. All three of us worked great. And, you know, with the warrior in there and doing it out of the director's chair in the middle of the ring, did the whole cigar thing, man. That was good times.
It seems like, you know, like you kind of have a footing in and you kind of don't, and then they bring you back, like you said, in 97. Did that frustrate you? Is that like a regret of yours? Are you pissed about that looking back? Because it's like you were there 95, 96, 97, but not for a long period of time, and it wasn't like a big deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, it was almost like they were trying to fucking rid me. Because in the end, they did the gangster character that I wanted to fucking do originally, that I thought would have made the most money. Because like I said, it was pre-Mr. Hughes, and you know, Mr. Hughes made some pretty good fucking jack doing that gangster gimmick. And I think I done it a whole hell of a lot better than he did. But it was pretty Hughes. And they finally gave me a chance to do it. And it works out great, man. Everything, you know, works out smooth as silk. And then they take it away from me. You know, don't call me after that. So I was a little disappointed. But, you know, what can you do? You know, I mean, they don't want to use you. They don't want to use you, you know.
Did you ever have any sort of relationship with Vince McMahon? Did you ever talk to him just more than just him loving the Mantar gimmick and the $100,000 head? Any other like kind of relationship or stories with Vince?
No, you know, I remember one time, I think I showed up at a show in Omaha. I went there to see Dave Finley. He's a good friend of mine that I worked with over in Europe for out of Vaughn's. Taught me the business, man, a really stand-up character. And so I went there to see him. And I remember I was weighing like, I don't know, 340 pounds. And I was sitting there fucking eating with Dave. And Vince came up, hit me on the fucking shoulder. He's like, Mike Halleck. He said, how the hell are you, man? He says, it's your hometown, huh? He's like, yeah. I stood up, shook his hand. And he was like, man, he says, you're looking pretty fit, man. I said, well, just wait for that phone call, Vince, you know, just wait for that phone call. And you know, that was kind of it. And the airport story in Denver. And then I remember me and my tag team partner, PN News, Dave Finley got us a tryout in like 98, I believe. Or no, sorry, 2010, got us a tryout. And we went down to Kemp Arena down in Kansas City. And the new arena in Kansas City. And we went to the new arena and we wrestled as the Brotherhood, as a tag team, because we were the tag team champs over in Europe. And I remember when we got there, there were guys that were still working there in the locker room that were there when I did the Mantar character and I did the Tank character and I did the fucking bodyguard character. So all these people fucking seen me and knew me, worked with me in all the years past. But nobody fucking talked to me. Nobody. Nobody talked to Paul. People knew Paul from the WCW locker room. Nobody fucking talked to him. And so we're sitting there in catering, just minding our own business, drinking a soda. And I remember as soon as Dave Fit Finley and Dean Malenko came up and said, hey, Paul, hey, Mike, how you guys doing? Give us hugs and shit. Then everybody came out of the fucking woodwork and was talking to us, right? Because if Dean Malenko and Dave Fit Finley are talking to you, well, then you must be somebody fucking important because these two guys ain't nothing to shake a stick at, right? These two guys got top-notch fucking reputations. And so we went out there and we did we were standing out there waiting. They were going over some people that were trying out, and I remember Harley had Nicole Bass there, and was trying to get John Laurinaitis to look at her, because John Laurinaitis was in the ring when everybody was doing the tryouts. And so he was like, Harley, wait a minute. And so he says, you two in the ring. So then we went and did our fucking spiel. And as soon as we came out of the ring, Harley Race is like, John, I need to talk to you. John's like, fuck off, Harley, I ain't got time. I got to talk to these two guys. I'm taking them in the back right now. And so we went in the back of the locker room, and when we wrestled our match, bro, we cleared out the fucking locker room. I mean, everybody who was in the locker room, whether it was The Rock or Stone Cold or The Big Show, fucking you name it, man, all the big guys, everybody that was on the fucking show was standing on the fucking ramp or out in the ring area when me and my partner fucking went in the ring and wrestled. And I guarantee you, man, there is no fucking way that we can bring these two 400 fucking pound guys in, because they are not going to be easy to fucking work with. And they are going to get over like Rover, and we're afraid of that. So everybody who cock-blocked it could have cock-blocked it, right?
So we were
in the best shape. We were in the best shape of our life, man. I was 362 pounds, and I had a fucking six-pack. Fucking Paul was benching over 60. He was benching 660. We were in the best shape of our life, man. We were in the gym for like a year fucking straight, two times a day, man. We were in shape, ready for this fucking tryout. And we got fucking blackballed.
Did they ever tell you, hey, you're not getting signed? You are, like, they never kind of said anything to you guys?
John said, well, the check will be in the bank. We're going to send you the check. And I've got our information. He says that we'll be in contact. And not only did we not get the check, the $300 check or whatever the fuck they were going to pay us, but we never got that phone call. So,
wow.
Total bullshit. But I mean, to tell you what, bro, and that's a highlight of my career. You know, that's like my WrestleMania fucking moment right there. Because anybody who was somebody in that fucking locker room that was in catering, fucking eating, and when we fucking hit the ring and they see us on the monitor, everybody came out and was standing. There was 100 guys standing on that fucking ramp, man. And they were all watching two 400-pounders fucking demolish these fucking two guys. I mean, we ate them up. And they were just like, wow, what the fuck? This is like Road Warrior type shit, but these guys are 400 pounds apiece. I mean, that's kind of the fucking feeling that was in the arena that day. I mean, it was fucking... I mean, I felt so good. I thought that we had the fucking spots locked up, brother. Thought we had them locked up. That's how good. I was on top of my game. I looked the best. Paul was fucking in shape. We looked fucking bad as a motherfucker. And they fucking blew us off.
Damn, what a shame. And it's interesting, too, because did you almost get signed by WCW at one point in the 90s? I know you wrestled Damian in a dark match, but was that ever a possibility, getting signed with WCW?
Yeah, you know, I was down there a little bit training the fucking power plant. You really try to break you down and see if you really want it. Well, you ain't going to fucking break me down, man. I'm a fucking true champion. I'm a born champion. And I'll do what it takes to get where I have to go. And there ain't no quitting fucking Mantar. And so I did all the fucking bullshit that they were doing in the power plant, squats, sit-ups, push-ups, doing it all, went there, fucking had some great matches in the power plant, went and did a TV thing, and then nothing. Crazy.
What about ECW? Because I know you had a bunch of matches for them, too. No, you know, no inkling of getting signed there either, right?
No, I worked up there for, I don't know, 2-3 months with Paulie, and you know, Paulie just was one of the type of guys where he just might not decide he don't want to pay you that night, right? And I did that to a lot of guys, and I just got tired of waiting for my fucking money. I mean, in fact, I think Paulie still owes me like $320, if my mind serves me correctly.
Wow, still. I mean, I know it's a story from a lot of different guys, but still owes you all that money. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah. I bet you. Listen, I bet you he still owes a lot of people, man. I bet you the 320 he owes me is something pocket change compared to what he owes some of these guys, right?
So that's why you stopped working there. I mean, it was you were only, I think, maybe a handful of matches, but you just stopped because of the lack of pay.
Yeah, just pay was fucking shit. So you get to the next town and if he owed you fucking $300 or $400, he might give you $200 and say, well, I owe you $200, and he already owed you fucking, $150 from the fucking night before, and I just kept fucking snowballing, and he just wasn't catching and getting caught up fast enough for me, and I said, I gotta go. I remember I was living with one of the pit bulls at the time, Anthony Durante. And I was like, listen, I was staying with him in South Philly, in the fucking hood. And I'm right across the street from fucking Gino fucking Cheesesteak's place. And I was like, I can't do this, man. I gotta go back to Nebraska.
When you look at like the run, it seems like Europe was very kind to you. Maybe not here in the States with the few short runs at WWF and USWA, but how come Europe was such like a great destination for it? It seems like Otto Vons and CWA was like your go-to.
It was, and the thing about that is Otto loved big guys. He loved fucking big guys, especially big guys that can move and work like I could. And so I remember when we got there, it was on a story that I'd been wrestling for 2 years. I was right directly out of fucking training camp. I had one fucking professional wrestling match. And my first match was in Dortmund, Germany in front of 9,000 fucking people. And a championship against my buddy, Luke Poirier, who I mentioned before with the Truth Commission, right? So he was the champ, and I had to wrestle him. And I remember I got through it, and after, I went and got my pay and shit, and I was like, how long have you been working? And Paul told me to tell everybody 2 years, right? So I told everybody 2 years. And so I told Otto 2 years. He was like, how long? It's like 2 years. He says, Mike, tell me the truth. He says, I know you ain't been working for 2 years. He says, I like your style. He says, but you got a lot to learn. And he says, but this is the place to do it. He said, so how long have you been working? He says, you want to know the truth, boss? He says, yeah. I said, this is my very first professional wrestling match. He says, slammed his fucking hand on the table. He says, you gotta be fucking kidding me, Mesquino. He says, your very first match, he says, you did one hell of a job, man, for your first match. He says, if you want to stay here and you want to learn how to fucking, the profession of professional wrestling, he says, we start the next city in 3 days in Bremen. He says, we're there for 38 days. I'm going to give you $365 a day. American, I'm going to pay you every 2 days. Are you in or are you out? I said, I'm in, boss. And that fucking, the rest is history, man. He fucking loved me, man. I wrestled Big Otto 3 or 4 times over there. And, great fucking guy. He built his name up when he bought that heavyweight championship off of the AWA, Nick Bockwinkel. Remember when he beat Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA heavyweight championship? Well, he took that fucker back to Europe. And when he brought it to his hometown, and that turned him into a fucking god, bro. Turned him into an instant millionaire. That $50,000 or $75,000 investment that he made, fucking was well worth it for him. And he loved big guys. And so he brought me back and he called me every fucking spring. He says, hey, Mesquino, you want to come back to Europe? I was like, hell yeah. He goes, all right. You'll have your tickets in a week. He says, I'll see you in a few weeks. I was like, okay, boss. That's his history, man. Eight and a half months, man, straight over in Europe, right?
Yeah, and then you would return a few times. Huh? So you had a couple runs in Europe for CWA.
Oh, yeah, I worked over there for, shit, I don't know, 8 or 9 years probably, total, long time.
It's crazy, some of the guys, if you look who you work, like Dave Taylor, Regal, even Chris Benoit. What was Benoit like?
So when I first got there, this was 91, 92. Dave Taylor kind of took me underneath his wing. And him and my partner, Paul, were really good friends. And so, but Dave kind of took me underneath his wing and kind of taught me the business. And so that
first 38 days, the top baby faces over there at the time were Owen Hart and Chris Benoit, Tony Sinclair and Dave Taylor. Well, Owen and Benoit were two of the best workers, so I would wrestle each one of them in singles matches every week. And then me and Dave would wrestle them in like tag teams like twice a week. And when I wasn't wrestling them, I was wrestling Dave Taylor, Tony Sinclair, you know, Steve Regal wasn't there at the time. But Chris Benoit and Owen Hart, they had a lot to do with teaching me the job. You know, because I worked with these guys on a nightly basis. I worked with them 5 nights a week. I was wrestling one of them. And I really learned a lot from those guys. You know, I'll never forget it. You know, people say, well, who taught you the business? Well, Dean Malenko and Jody Malenko and Larry Malenko, their father, taught me the job. But Dave Finley and Owen Hart and Chris Benoit, they gave me firsthand wrestling experience on a nightly basis. You know, and I'm wrestling three of the fucking best technical wrestlers in the whole fucking world, right? And so I was blessed.
What did you think of Benoit as, like, the person, Benoit the guy? I mean, what was he like?
You know, what I remember of Chris back then was he was just very quiet, always to himself, you know. Just kind of doing his own lone wolf, you know. Just kind of was doing his own thing, marching to his own drum. And Owen was a fucking pistol. Owen was just Owen. And I remember when I first got to New York, when I did the Mantar character, Owen was one of the first guys that came up to me and gave me a big hug and fucking and catering. He was like, Bruiser Mastino, you know it, buddy. Come give me a big fucking hug and shit. And Owen used to be the best river man there ever was, you know. He'd walk around with a towel on his arm and a squirt gun underneath that fucking towel, and he's walking by in the fucking hallway, he's gonna blast you in the fucking eye. That squirt gun, you're like, what the fuck, where did that come from? And Owen just got a fucking towel on his arm, you don't think it's him. And I remember one time, man, I just got a new suitcase. Just bought a new Halliburton. And because I had a soft one before and it just wasn't working out, so I bought a Halliburton, a hard one. And I went to the seamstress ladies because they used to help me paint my face. And so I went to paint my fucking face and I came back and my Halliburton has a fucking logging chain wrapped around it. And it's chained to the fucking bench. And it's got a lock on it the size of a fucking football. Right, my huge ass lock. I'm like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? And so I'm looking around, I'm looking for the fucking maintenance guy, and I finally found the maintenance guy, and I've been searching for like an hour, 15 minutes. And I'm on in like fucking 10 minutes, and I finally tracked down the maintenance guy. His owner said, listen, just go and hide, man. Just, you see this big fucking guy with horns on his head, man, just tell him you don't know nothing, just act stupid. And so, yeah. I mean, he was totally all in on the gimmick, and it was totally Owen, right? Because he'll do whatever it takes sometimes to pull off a rib, right? Owen will go that extra fucking, he'll go that extra mile to pull the rib off. And so, I remember I tracked down the fucking dude, and I'm sweating bullets, man. I'm fucking pain, starting to fucking run, I'm like, fuck me, and I'm in my socks and my trunks, and I'm like, what the fuck? I got to get in that suitcase. So I finally found the maintenance guy and he says, listen, man, I was like, if you fucking give me a pair of fucking bolt cutters, I said, I'll give you $50, man. I said, I need to get in my suitcase. Some fuckers pulled a rib on me and chained my suitcase to the bench. And the guy said, well, let me see, $50, huh? And I was like, yeah, yeah. Okay, I guess I can do it for $50. And so he gets some bolt cutters and I'm rushing him down the fucking hallway. It seems like we got to go a fucking mile to get to the locker room, right? Because I mean, I'm on in like fucking 7-8 minutes. And I finally give it over, man. He fucking busted, man. I fucking bust that thing off. I give him the fucking 50. And Owen comes in. He says, hey, Bruiser. He says, see if I can get that suitcase open, huh? He says, that was one hell of a fucking padlock on that fucker. He says, you ever padlock that? Whoever put that on there, he says, I don't think they like you very much. And so the fucking maintenance guy gives Owen the fucking $50 that I paid him. He says, here. He says, you can have it. I don't want it. And Owen said, oh, Bruiser. He said, is this your 50? He says, joke's on you, buddy. He says, better hurry up, man. You're out in 5 minutes, right? So I had to put my boots on, my sealant on, my all my pads, my tape. I mean, I was fucking hustling, man. But fucking Owen pulled the ultimate rib, man, and fucking just got my bag open in the nick of time. Good times, man. I miss Owen Hart. I miss Owen a lot, you know, because, you know, Brett and I, we have each other's numbers, and I'll text Brett every now and then, you know, just to say hello. And, you know, he said that Owen would say nothing but good things about me, man. He said, so if my brother liked you, he says, then I like you. And, you know, Brett even took a more shining to me after we went and had that great match, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's pretty awesome, though, with Owen. I mean, always known as the consummate ribber. You know, just nothing hellacious, but nothing crazy, but just a good ribber. Funny guy.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
So as we hit the wind down here, we head towards the finish. What's next for you? I know a few years ago you did wrestle GCW, Game Changer. You were in the clusterfuck with Joey Janela and stuff. Like, are you still wrestling? Or will you wrestle in the future? What's next for you?
Well, you know, I'm down here. I'm living in Florida, as you know already. Down in sunny Cape Coral, Florida, Southwest Florida. And life is great down here, man. I've been down here for about 10, 11 months now, almost a year, on May 14th, on my birthday. And, you know, I just been kind of pill-dicking around the gym. I've blown like 35 pounds already. So I'm down to like 370. And if I can get down to 3 1/4, which I'm really honestly trying to get down and cut that weight. If I get down to 3 1/4, you know, I'll start working again. You know, I've been getting a lot of phone calls. My messenger's been blowing up. People want me to do podcasts and want me to come in and do signings and wrestle a tag or do a run-in, you know, anything. I was like, listen, if you just do a run-in, I'll be happy with that. So, you know, I'm trying to put myself out there more now. I have my own podcast now, actually, where we just got done taping episode 8. It's actually on Monty and the Pharaoh Network right now at Tuesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern. So instead of me watching the podcast, I'm on here with you, Big John. Shit, man. Entertainment fans. And, you know, so we're on the Monty and the Pharaoh Network. Our podcast is called SOB Sports Network, something along boys or son of a bitch, whatever you want to call us. It's SOB Sports Network. And you can look us up on YouTube, and we're on Podbean and stuff like that. And we're just trying to get started, getting our names out there, but I'm getting a lot of interest now. And I've kind of opened up the floodgates on the Facebook and getting ready to open up Instagram or Twitter. You know, hopefully I'll be dabbling in a few movies this summer. So, yeah, man, things are looking up, and I'm training every day for bigger and better things to come later on this summer.
Nice. Sounds great. Sounds like you got a lot of things down the hopper there.
Yeah,
down the bike.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've been doing this podcast stuff for a long time now, and it seems to be working out for you. You know, you've interviewed a lot of top guys, and you really got your brand out there and your name out there. And, you know, I envy you because, you know, that's not easy to do. And, you know, me and Pete News, we're only on episode 8, but, you know, we're getting a lot of positive feedback. You've got a lot of guys love us. And the thing is both him and myself have been cockblocked so many times that now nobody can cockblock us because it's our own show. And we can do whatever the hell we want. We can say what we want. And, you know, I'm sure you heard that story a couple weeks ago of WrestleMania about who was it? Rick Steiner said something to that transvestite, right? And I chimed in and I said, you know, I agree with Rick Steiner. I was like, there's no room in sports for someone who's transgender, period. There's no fucking room in sports for it. You know, it's just not fair. You know, you got a man that competes in swimming events and comes in 100th place every time. And then he says, well, I'm a fucking she now. And so he starts competing in women's swimming events and now he's winning the fucking gold medal. I mean, is that right? I don't think so. You know, I mean, you know, God made a man, God made a woman, and he don't talk about no fucking mixture, he don't talk about no transgender, nothing in the Bible. And, you know, I'm old school, so, you know, I signed with Rick Steiner on that, you know, and I caught some flack, you know, but I really don't give a fucking shit, because it's my opinion, I'm entitled to it. If you don't like it, then fucking don't listen to me or turn away, you know. But in my opinion, there is absolutely no fucking room in sports for someone who is transgender. Now, if you want to live your life as a transgender, I'm all for it, bro. You want to go out and party and have dinner and go to nightclubs and, you know, go to grocery stores as a woman and you're a man, hey, more power to you. Just stay the fuck out of sports. That's all I'm saying. Just stay out of sports. I'm not a homophobe. I'm not a transphobe. And I'd be called them all, man, trust me. And like I said, I really don't give a shit. But in my opinion, there's just no fucking room at all. Not 1 inch, not 1 centimeter, not anything. There's no room in sports for someone who's transgender.
Well, as far as you, and obviously, you know, you got the podcast, can you wrestle one last match, like, or maybe several matches, or what?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if I could drop another 45, 50 pounds, you know, the plan is to start wrestling again, you know, at least once a month. And, you know, I could go out there and, you know, take a bump here and a bump there. I really don't have to bump around. I'm 400 pounds, right? I mean, there's more ways to work around that for sure. But, you know, I miss entertainment. And that's why, you know, Paul and I started this podcast, SLB Sports Network, you know, because we miss entertaining our fans so much. And this gives us a chance to get up front and personal and let the fans know who we really are as people, right? I mean, because I'm no different than you. Just because I did 3 different characters for the WWF, I'm no better than you are. I just got a chance, and I got the ball, and I ran with it, and I did the best I could with what I was dealt. And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure if you would have had the chance, you would have put your mark on the business somehow, right? So, I mean, I don't think I'm better than you or better than anybody else. I'm just a lucky guy who got a break, and me and God happened to be down like this, like 2 flat tires, right? So,
oh, yeah.
So good.
Well, Mike, thank you so much, or Mantar, thank you so much for all the time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem, John. Anytime, man. I'd like to come on and talk to you anytime. You know, I might even have you on our podcast someday. We'll bring you on SLB Sports, and we can do an interview you. We can kind of switch the roles a little bit. You know?
All right. I like that. I'm down. I'm down for that.
That's what it's about, man, is to promote each other and to tell honest and truthful stories and tell funny stories, right, that people would have no idea what's going on behind closed doors unless people tell stories.
Yep. You know,
it all comes from your experiences, your life, your real-life experiences. And so, you know, if you find my real-life experiences entertaining and interesting, then I'm still doing my job, right? And like I said earlier, you know, it's been 28 fucking years since I did Mantar, and people are still talking about me. And good, bad, or ugly, I don't care, but they're still talking about me. And whether it's a belly-to-belly suplex, whether it was the Mantar shuffle, whether it was just a fucking bullhead, I don't care. I'm just happy that I have fans out there that love me, adore me. And you know what? If I can make somebody's life better, just a little pinch, if I could just make their life just a little bit better during the course of the day, or inspire them in any way, shape, or form, that's what it's all about. Because I'll tell you what, I worked hard in my life as a professional wrestler. I give everything that I had to the job. I moved like a middleweight out there in the ring. I flew around like I was, you know, Twinkle Toes on Cinderella. And so I have done it all. I've done the squats. I've done the push-ups. I've let my blood, sweat, and tears out there in the ring to entertain you fans. And so I definitely appreciate all the love that you're giving back to me on a daily basis. I hear it every day. People send me a text, Mantar, I love the Mantar gimmick. You were the man in the WWF. Well, you should be in the Hall of Fame. Well, you know what? WWE Hall of Fame doesn't really mean nothing to me because, in my opinion, it's a fucking joke. You know, it's a who's who. And, you know, if you know this guy, you want to put him in, okay, we're going to put him in. You know, I mean, this last class, who did they put in? Sable, for fuck's sake. What the fuck has she done? She was just one of the original fucking divas that looked good. That's all she did. You know, so, I mean, if they're going to put people like Sable in, you know, they've done absolutely nothing for the wrestling business. It's a joke. You know, it's a joke. I mean, I'm glad that, you know, Rey Mysterio got in this year. You know, I'm happy for a lot of people, but, you know, for it's a lot of, you know, again, clicky friends putting their clicky friends in the Hall of Fame. Like, this is my buddy. I want him to go. You know, like, when you see the click, you see the 1-2-3 kid was in there for the 1-2-3 kid. You see he was in there for DX. You see Triple H was in, you know, Triple H, D-Generation X, this one, that one. You know, and, hey, man, in my opinion, it's a friends fucking Hall of Fame and not a true wrestling Hall of Fame.
True. It's interesting, like who gets in and who doesn't get into the Hall of Fame. But
yeah, I mean, how do they come up with that shit? I mean, you know, is there a fucking criteria that you got to meet?
Nope. Or
that, you know, you got to check certain things off your fucking list in your career? You got to be like a four-time fucking champion, whether it's tag team or individual. You know, what the fuck is it? You know,
I mean, there's no criteria.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I can understand putting some of these celebrities in. You know, like Donald Trump and Cyndi Lauper, and, you know, I can understand, you know, some of them people because they had really entertaining matches when they were there, and people remember that shit, right? And so even though they, you know, they had a one-off or two-off or three-off, whatever, they still made their mark. But, you know, when you put people in, like, Sable, who just looks good, just looks the part, that makes no sense. She didn't do nothing fucking in professional wrestling that... She never had no wrestling skills, you know, so why should she be in a professional wrestling Hall of Fame because she looks like a 9.5 out of fucking 10? Give me a break. Fucking simply outstanding. Look how good I look, man. I deserve a fucking spot in the Hall of Fame, for God's sake. I mean, look at it. Right? You got a beautiful smile? I think that's Hall of Fame fucking worthy, but I don't give a shit about the fucking Hall of Fame because, like I said, it's all a who's who and who's done it, and, you know, I mean... People that they put in posthumously, they should have put in when they were fucking alive, but they didn't because there was some bullshit fucking heat. And now you want to put them in now that they're fucking dead? Fuck that shit, man. You know, if you're not a friend to me when I'm alive, you're not going to talk to me when I'm alive or check on me when I'm alive. Don't show up at my fucking funeral to say goodbye. Because you have plenty of chances to come talk to me in fucking real life. All it takes is, you know, 10 fucking 20 seconds out of one person's day to send a text and say, hey, big man, what's going on? You know, but you want to show up when I'm fucking dead or make some big fucking spectacle? Do it now, man. Do it now while I'm alive. And you know, whether we got a beef or whether we got to tell some funny stories about some experiences we had, whatever, man, let's just share together while we're here because, listen, we're all our tickets are numbered any fucking way. And it's not up to us how long we're here for. It's up to God. And, you know, I've already been dead on the table for 20 minutes. And so I know that I'm on borrowed time. And so I can't tell you how blessed I feel. I've seen the white light. I've seen the angels. I've been on heaven's gates, man. I've been there and done that already. And so I know that I got a spot in heaven. God gave me a chance to live or die. And I chose to live. And he fucking made me start breathing again after they shocked me 3 fucking times. And were giving me CPR for about 22 minutes, you know. So, I mean, I'm blessed, man. Every day I wake up, man, I just like thank you, God, for opening up my eyes and let me, you know, trying to put a stamp on today's world, right? You know, I think this world would be a lot better. It would be a lot better place if people would just be a little kinder to each other, you know, show some love and kindness and have compassion because, you know, you never know. What someone else is going through, right? And hey, man, how you doing? Just wanted you to know that I'm thinking about you and I hope you're doing fine. That could change somebody's whole fucking life around, man. They could be on death's door. putting a pistol to their fucking head, and they get your text, and all of a sudden they throw that fucking pistol down. What the fuck am I doing, man? I'm still loved and I'm still wanted. So you never know somebody else's position in life. So you should always be kind. You should always edge on the kindness side and the love side. And if we spread more kindness and love, like I said, this world would be a lot better off than we are now.
Totally agree. It's a great way to end it, too. Great point, Mantar. But thank you so much for all the time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, John, it's been my pleasure, man. I'm really happy to be on the two-man power trip. Ladies and gentlemen, John P. here, he's the man, and two-man power trip. And don't forget, SOB Sports Network on Monty and the Pharaoh platform. Check us out. We've got our own platform on YouTube. So we're just getting started. But, hey, you know, give us a helping hand and like, share, and subscribe. And appreciate it, man. All the love, man. Thanks, Big John. It's been a pleasure.
All right. This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother.